Welcome to Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Pat, I'm especially pleased to be talking to our guest today. While forces swirl around attempting to erase some of America's most important history lessons, like the Tuskegee Airmen, Navajo Code Talkers, civil rights leaders, we have the honor of speaking to a secular saint who rubs shoulders with civil rights royalty, Martin Luther King Jr., Sr., and the Third. Your recent book on food insecurity, Humble Pie, featured a brief passage of your interview from a journey we made 9 months ago, and we visited the home of Jackie Sawyer and spent time with Jackie and her daughter, Cindy, and I would like for you to read that now, if you don't mind.
A shy teen, Cindy Sawyer, hid in the bedroom when Martin Luther King Sr., Daddy King as they called him, and his grandson, Martin Luther King III, visited her home. It wasn't the first time that members of the nation's most iconic civil rights family visited the Sawyer's Richmond, Indiana home. Before his assassination, MLK Jr. would drop by to confer with George Sawyer, an Eastern Indiana attorney, civil rights leader, and founder of African American Studies at Earlham College. Still, it wasn't until after MLK Jr.'s mother, Alberta Williams King's assassination, that King's extended family journeyed to Indiana and dined at the Sawyer home. There they enjoyed the loving embrace food and fellowship provide.
Welcome, Cindy and Jackie. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Good to be here. Yes.
Thank you.
We were, was it only 9 months ago, Max?
It was. Well, it was, I mean, to me, that's a long time ago, but I had to look back at my calendar and say, okay, I know we went to Richmond. When was that? And yeah, it was way, way back.
Wow. Because you folks were, I think, the last interviews that I conducted for the book Humble Pie. It was just so perfect to be able to meet you. I think I'm, you know, clever. Part of my problem is I'm my biggest fan some days. But I really wanted to, Humble Pie is a play on words, and I really wanted that humble pie, hungry for justice, right? And that's the chapter. Jackie, your picture's on the cover of that, your illustration's on the cover of that chapter. Maybe we should just back up a little bit and Jackie, you can tell us maybe, or Cindy, whoever wants to jump in, a little bit of the story of you folks being in Richmond, Indiana, and the role that you played at Earlham College, because that was really, was that the start of your dad being a civil rights activist, or did he end up at Earlham because of that?
Well, basically, it ended up in at Earlham, but I had been in Townsend Center working with the youth and different programs with them since I was 8 years old.
Wow. Oh, wow. And where were you 8 years old? Where did you grow up?
I grew up here in Richmond, Indiana, and I went to Townsend Community Center for until I was 18 and got a job there, and it was wonderful.
So tell us a little bit. Now, I had the really wonderful honor of being at the Richmond Library with you a month or so ago, and we heard some incredible stories. The Black History Project was there. We heard some incredible stories about incredible segregation that as a kid who grew up in Rhode Island, I remember my mother out, you know, picketing and boycotting for civil rights and marching for civil rights and then not telling my father she had done it because, you know, he would have been mad. But I didn't realize things like you couldn't even go roller skating in this. You had to change the town you went roller skating in because there was only one night the Black kids could skate.
Yes, that's true.
This was the situation you grew up in.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there were more Black people who had businesses around. So at the moment, as growing up, we didn't miss some of the other things. We were going to, we weren't going to the Y. We weren't going anywhere except to the couple restaurants here, and Townsend Center had a big program going from children from 5 years old up to the adults. And so we sort of have grown up with the community.
Yeah. So did you, when you were 8, 9, 10, did you think, why are we separated?
Not at the moment, because there were so many activities going on that we didn't miss what was happening. It was later in my lifetime that we discovered that we're not supposed to do this.
Huh. Wow. I can't imagine, and I don't know if you can tell me, what is it like to think for absolutely no reason other than the pigmentation of your skin, people don't want me around?
That basically was what their neighbor would think, or what their friend would think. And therefore, that is some of it that kept us apart. Except when we were in high school, we were going to school with some of these students. But when it came to the sports and
dances?
Yes.
Could you do dances together?
No. We weren't together.
Could you sit next to a white kid?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. But they sort of segregated themselves to a section, and the black followed through with their section with the student.
So it wasn't necessarily a requirement that you be there and you be there, but it just kind of naturally happened that they migrated to the places that ended up separating them. Is that correct?
Yes. And I think basically because neither group of us were missing anything, because we were all skating, we were all dancing, we were all in clubs. And so we didn't miss what was going on at the time.
So you didn't think that if the white kids got to skate 5 nights a week and you only got to skate 1 night a week, you didn't think, what's so great about the white people?
Oh, we can go skating now?
Oh, wow.
No, it was more or less, we can have a dance out there at the country club? Oh, you could, just things like that brought us to where we finally came to, that we were doing some of the same things, but not able to do everything.
Yeah. Cindy, when you hear your mom, when you hear these stories,
It was separate but equal. That's how the community.
Yeah, that was a good catchphrase, wasn't it?
Yeah. When you hear her talk about this, I'm heartbroken. And she's not my mom. Is this hard for you?
You know, what it makes me think of is there was a time when I was in my brother and I both were in the back seat when we were living in Indianapolis. I was probably 6 or 7. And there was a swim club called the Miramar Club. And to go to school, we would pass by the Miramar Club. And usually to go home, we would pass the swim club. And my brother had asked many times, what was that? And my dad explained that it's a swimming club. And so he said, they have a pool in there? Yes. And so that's where the conversation would always end. But one day, my brother demanded that he be able to swim there. And the air in the car changed. I remember, I'm a year older than my brother, and I remember this. The air changed. My mom and my dad got together and sort of discussed something quickly. And it was sort of like, is now the time? And so my father said to him, Donnie, they don't allow black people to swim at that club. And my brother said, why not? He said, Black people are not welcome.
And what year is this? Because, I mean, you're so much younger, obviously, than your mother, but this is pretty recent history then.
That's true. Even though it's in Indiana. That was...
It was Thursday. It was last week.
No. No. That was probably 67, maybe. And so it makes me sad, but what I recognize is that that stuff didn't just go away. Mm. So when I went to college in Illinois, and I was with a clown troupe, and we would go to different churches and do clown ministry stuff. And I had been told that there was a town in Illinois called Pekin that was a sundown town, which means that Black people are not allowed to be there after sundown. And so I knew that, but I had no reason to go to Pekin. But then they asked us to come, and some people agreed that they would come with me, but ultimately it ended up just being me being able to go. And I didn't know what to do. I got a friend to go there with me. And I explained to her on the way there that this was a sundown town and we need to hope that we got done quickly so that I would be out of town in time. Okay. So I had clown makeup on and I had gloves on. Not really. I mean, that's just what my costume was. And so did my thing. And this is like an old Methodist church. So I'm saying goodbye to people, pastors at the front, at the back of the church. And so I'm standing there near the front, and this woman and her daughter are standing, these two white women are standing there, and they're probably about 5 or 6 yards away from me. And the daughter says, "See, Mom, I told you that was a colored woman." And I was like, oh my gosh. I was terrified. I didn't know what to do. And so I just, you know, I was a silent clown, thank goodness. And so I silently said goodbye and I got out as quickly as I could.
How old were you then?
I was in college.
That's still, wow.
Yeah. Wow. You know, people who are either unaware or are young don't realize that there were whites-only golf courses until very recently.
True.
That private businesses until very recently, probably the 2000s, have been allowed to keep people out. And that's what the new, they just changed the federal regulation on segregation, mm-hmm. like just a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. so that you can segregate again. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, most of the states have a state law against it. But this is mind-blowing, first of all, that we're going backwards at such record speed, especially because we weren't all the way forward yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, make America great again, regardless of why you think you support the Republican Party, is just make America white again. Mm. And silence and set aside every person of color that you can. And anyone who pretends that it's not a racist agenda is lying to themselves about mm-hmm. it. But I remember I was working for a television station, and a competing television station had a station manager who told me that he golfed at this one particular golf course. And I said, well, that's a whites only golf course. And he said, yeah, but you know, I've seen really incredible things happen there. I've seen incredible, really courageous people. I saw one guy golf with a broken leg, and I said, "So you think that these people are okay because they're strong and they deserve to be respected because they're strong?" And I said, "How many of the Black chefs worked with a broken leg?" Or were, you know, I mean, did you even pay attention to the, you know, they'll let Black people in, but they have to come in as the service people. And it flabbergasted me that people could look you in the face and explain their racism as sensible.
Because it's not.
Right. But I think what's important is it makes sense to them. Like from their perspective, it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense to have a... since you want your child to do better than you, then it makes a lot of sense to try to create a society in which they do. And white people's experience has been that white people were on top. And so that's how they made sure that happened. And so the competition with Black people and brown people is primarily because they want to make sure that their kids got at least what they had or maybe more.
Yeah, and that included pushing other people out of the line.
Well, because they don't think that people necessarily belong in the line. You know, I don't want to go way far off, but when I was in grad school, I wrote a paper on the biblical foundation of slavery. And so I was going through the library and I found all these books and I was doing great until I got stuck. I couldn't figure out my way out of it for anything. It seemed like the argument held. And so I talked to a friend who was a seminarian, and she said the foundation of the theory that they were coming from and in that white people were coming from back then is flawed. And that's why the arguments continue to make sense, because the foundation was flawed. And she explained that the foundation was that when white folks came to America, they believed that they were Israel and that they could do anything that it said in the Bible Israel did, including having slaves. And so they believed that God had given them this land and that it was their responsibility to come and take the land. Once she told me that, it was very easy to then find reasons why the argument didn't hold. And what I had not understood until that time was that during that time, there were lots of back and forth between the theologians. The Northern theologians would say this, you guys are going to hell. The Southern theologians were like, you guys don't, it doesn't matter. We're following God's way. It was going back and forth. There was a strong belief that from the Northern people, that the South was going to be judged by God. And there were actually Northerners that were encouraging the South to secede because they didn't want that judgment on them.
Yeah, I kind of know how they feel. I'm ready to get rid of a few states myself.
So foundationally, what happened was that they decided this book said that if the church split along racial lines, North and South lines, that then there would be a civil war. So the theologians were kind of trying to hold things together because they could see if the fracturing was going to be really a horrific outcome. But what was interesting in this book was that this author believed that if the church had not split, that slavery could have gone into the 19th century.
Wow. Well, I think that the goal now is that an indenture of certainly a type of slavery will be resurged, right? Will come back. So, Jackie, both you and Cindy, how we're looking at what Max's introduction was perfect. We're looking at a time now where they want the history, what you've already lived through, to be erased so they can do it again, right? If you look back at history, you see that this happened and then you see that it's wrong. So they get it out of the history books as though there's no example of wrongdoing. How does it feel to have fought your whole life for equality to see them trying to take it away from your children, your grandchildren?
Yeah. In talking with some of the ones right now who are 40 and 45, they feel like there wasn't anything but always integration and all. So this is learning to them too. What a lot of us did as Black people, we knew these things, we just didn't talk about them. Even to our neighbor or to, we just kept it to ourselves.
So why do you think that was?
I guess because they were trying to not bring up anything Black or anything ugly or anything, because they haven't lived like that. And things, so about what, 40, 42, 45? They don't know all of this. They're learning about what happened here in Richmond, even. this little small town. And another thing, the ones who were in office at the time had a lot to do with how people were going to react if someone came to join them. And it wasn't always that way. It was just what they would do is, I wouldn't go there. I wouldn't do that. Oh, you want to? I'll find out for you, you know. So you can, so I'll be back with you and we can talk. But most of these people were prominent people who were on the board, who were making sure that these didn't go. Although they were excited about sports, they were excited about football, blacks in football, blacks in basketball, and how that was a difference or something, but it was.
It doesn't make any sense either. It's like, you know, athletes are great and all, but you're just missing all of the other great accomplishments that have been given by the black communities. It's senseless.
Well, so it's always follow the money, right?
Yeah.
Who's going to make a great athlete is going to make even a high school is going to be more, have better attendance at games and stuff. So when we came to see you, and I had talked to your son, Don Sawyer, about you a lot. He's very proud of you. I think, you know, all your kids are really proud of you. And he was telling me about you making dinner after the assassination because I'm constantly wanting to apologize for how stupid a white person I am, I assumed it was the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. because I knew it was your husband had been friends with MLK Jr. They had worked together on civil rights. I assumed it was his assassination. I'm 63 years old, sitting in your living room, and I learn that Alberta Williams King was assassinated 5 years after her son was. Shot in the head 3 times in the Ebenezer Baptist Church while she's playing the organ by a man who had allegedly never held a gun before. No one else in the church was hit by a bullet. An incredibly lucky marksman, considering it was his first time he ever held a gun. Drove down from Ohio. I make it my life's job now to make sure every single person, white person I meet, knows that Martin Luther King Jr.'s mother was killed in the church. Because if George Washington's mother had been killed in the church, you better believe we would have known it, right? Mm-hmm. So just that piece of history that I lived through, I was alive. I was 13 years old. I wasn't even told it happened.
Well, that's the devastating thing, too, with erasing these months of history and let's study the history of all these different cultures and groups. And now they're like rolling back all of that. I was in the military as an equal opportunity representative trying to promote those events and those months while I was there. And it kills me that some of those things that I work for in the military aren't there. So it's like erasing history that, I mean, in some cases, in the case of what you were talking about with Martin Luther King Jr.'s mother, it had already technically been erased because I didn't know about that history either.
And that might be part of the insidious nature of what's going on right now is, like I said, we didn't fix the problem before we started unwinding it. You know, after World War II, the U.S. soldiers went house to house in Germany and they did two things. They took away people's weapons and because, you know, the war was over. They didn't want to get shot. They took away people's weapons and they showed them pictures of the concentration camps. They went door to door and said, see this? You did this. You might have been a school teacher. You might have been a chemist or a pharmacist. You might have gone to work every day. But you were a German citizen in Germany during this, and you didn't stop it. And they called it the denazification of Germany. That was the name of the campaign. And we never denazified the United States. We never showed the pictures of, you know, babies being ripped from their mother's arms and being sold to the farmer 40 miles away.
Yeah.
We never denazified the United States so that we don't see our crimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we were, as you point out, things that were happening, they were happening, but at the time we were saying to ourselves, not to other people, but to ourselves, oh, these things are going to change nobody. But at that time, there was no change going on. But it was like, oh, well, we'll talk about that some other time. Or you'll have somebody like, you've heard this name before, I'm sure, Bobby Smith. He was all over, and everybody knew who he was and why he was and where he was going. There was no doubt, no question, to the point where some of the Black students, I mean, some of the Black people in the neighborhood say, oh, Lord, there goes old Bobby. Oh, Lord, that goes old Bobby. Meaning he didn't have a following as such. He was talking. He was telling the truth. But he didn't have anybody but himself and his family.
So why do you think that is?
Well, that was part of some of the Black people coming up and saying, well, he's here. He's real. It's for real, you know. And so then in their lives, the same things had been kept, keeping up. I'd like to bring up something that happened. There is a book out. What is it? Oh, the book. The only picture of a Black person in there is Martin Luther King when he was here and went over to Earlham to give a speech. At the time, there were maybe 5 or 6 Black students at Earlham.
This is a book about Earlham.
Yeah.
Or a book about Richmond.
Thanks for that clarification.
Yes. And so, but I can't tell the year. I don't remember the year. But some of the people from Earlham encouraged some of the Black students to come to Earlham. So there was a time when there were maybe like 30 or something Black students all at once for this exchange. Well, that was quite an exchange for the Quakers and for the white students and all.
So how does, because you had 3 generations of kings. I don't know if Martin Luther King III spoke at Earlham. I assume that both Senior and Junior did at one time. How does Earlham, which is in tiny Richmond, Indiana, how do they get such civil rights royalty at that university?
Well, part of that comes from Cindy's dad, George Sawyer. And he was very, and he was a Quaker, and he was very inspirational. I mean, he talked, he traveled and for Earlham to include. So that is one of the persons who helped exchange Earlham.
Yeah. He started the Black Studies curriculum at Earlham, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that part of it is that Quakers have a theology that they weren't necessarily living at the time, and an idealism that they really believed in, but wasn't being actualized. And so my father held them to it, not always gently, often directly, but because it was a theology that they cherished, then they often had to wrestle with themselves. And Quakers are known for wrestling. So I think that they would not just accommodate what he was thinking, but recognize that there was some truth to it.
Yeah, but people may or may not know that Richard Nixon was a Quaker. So they're kind of polar opposites. You know, it's interesting because what your mom has been talking about reminds me of the story of Jesse Owens, right? The black man who competed in the Berlin Olympics in 1936, embarrassing Hitler because he competed so well. And the part of the Jesse Owens story that people don't talk about is the fact that there were four Jews on the U.S. Olympic team at the time. And because the United States didn't want to embarrass Hitler too much or offend him too much, they didn't allow the Jews to compete. And so Jesse Owens had a problem with that. The white members of the team didn't. But Jesse Owens had a problem with that. And at one point after Jesse Owens won his first medal, he said, "I am giving my space on the next running thing." It was part of a relay. "To any of the Jewish athletes who wants it." And the U.S. Olympic team threatened Jesse Owens that he would be sent home if he continued to advocate for the Jewish athletes. And so it seems as though you have to get people who understand oppression into the conversation. Because the oppressors are never going to get it. Right? Right? And it sounds like your dad was able to be inside this Quaker community,
yeah,
you know, and say, "Sorry, you guys don't get it." Right? Yeah. This, you have to have a seat at the table. And maybe what's happening right now is that seat's being trying to be taken away at every chance.
You know, what resonates with what you just said is that they asked my dad to set up a panel during an annual yearly meeting where Quakers from all over the Midwest were coming. They asked him to set up a panel discussing gay folks and Quakerism. And this was probably, I don't know, 82, 83. And so they asked him what the plans were. And so he gave the plans and such, but he did not let them know that he was inviting gay people to it, to be on the panel. It caused Quakers to not be able to find consensus. I'll put it that way. And it was all about the fact that they wanted to have a conversation outside the presence of gay people to sort of discuss where gay people should fit within the context of Quakerism. But my father was not having it. So I think you're right.
Yeah.
And that lived experience thing, I know Pat talks about this all the time, that, you know, with the DEI and removing people from these discussions, you're taking away people with lived experience that can speak to what it's like. And that's devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just did a news story on the presidential order eliminating DEI and the people who've lost their jobs in the government because of that. And one classification that they've eliminated is the people in the housing offices who were homeless. Mm. The people with lived homeless experience, regardless of their color, regardless of their gender, regardless of how they identify, were removed because just the fact that they had more experience with the problem made them a DEI hire. Mm. And, you know, that's like taking cancer patients out of healthcare. You know, it's just like this is how the oppressor stays in charge of everything. And it seems crazy and chaotic, but it's evil genius, right? It's methodical and one step at a time. What can you tell people today who want to resist? Your whole life, Jackie, and I don't know enough about you, your life, Cindy, to know whether or not you've had to resist as much as your mom did. But Jackie, your whole life has been resisting people telling you can't.
Yes. And more or less in conversations with people, it didn't seem the right time to bring it up, segregation and all. It wasn't. And I think part of that, and I go back, way back, and part of that is there were several other activities and things that Black people were operating, you know, not the skating rink, but restaurants and then Townsend Center. So it wasn't really anybody to discuss it.
Hmm.
Even in your family, you know, it wasn't years and years and years ago. It was happening, but it wasn't anything to upset the whatever the affair was. But I have to say, I have to go up back a little bit. And Bobby Smith is one that traveled all around, told everything and everything. And some of the people say, no, it didn't. Yes, it did. No, it didn't. He is really one of the ones who had things started. And people thought he was crazy.
Yeah. Well, there's a famous, I was listening to the granddaughter of Malcolm X, and she was talking about how for the longest time, Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X seemed to be at complete odds, at least to the white community. One had, and that her grandfather felt that Martin Luther King Jr. was waiting for the white people to come around. Peaceful resistance was a way to patiently wait for the white people to stop being jerks. And she said her grandfather felt that the only thing that was going to stop it was if Black people stopped them from mistreating them, that it had to be in action. And that she said, but eventually the power of Martin Luther King's quiet patience, especially when he started talking about Vietnam and poverty and things that influenced or affected so many people outside the Black community, mm-hmm. that Martin Luther King's quietness actually became a force. Mm-hmm. It was a force, and sort of the quietness I hear you talking about. We didn't make a fuss, but we didn't disquiet the event. But after a while, that became such a force because it was so universally embraced by so many people. So many people said, we can be quiet and be quietly obstructive of this. But resistance is still necessary. And that's what I hear you saying, is that the resistance was much more. It seems to me that your ultimate revenge on being treated so egregiously was raising three fantastic kids with confidence and energy and intelligence that are out in the community making a difference. You know, I mean, it's almost like raising your children, having the discussion in the front seat. Is this the time we tell them now that we're surrounded by racists? Right. You protected your children. Another story that you tell is when you were afraid they were going to firebomb your house. People watching your house, and you had to protect your children and take them to another place and take them out of the town. Yeah.
No. So I was going to ask Jackie and Cindy. So that threat of potentially having your house firebombed, what was that like for you and your family?
It was scary, and we hadn't really seen George knowing to get us out of town. So we went to a minister and his wife's home in Indianapolis. for a while. The one of them who threatened was just lived about four houses from us.
So you knew that someone four houses away was threatening you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, when we moved into this neighborhood, that was, and we've been here, what, 53 years or so. I mean,
and built a beautiful home, by the way.
In and out, in and out. But the thing is that before that, there weren't any Black people in except Dr. and Dr. Brooks.
Brooks. Mm.
Dr. Brooks, who was up on the, and they built a beautiful home and all, and they disturbed this area. At the same time, people were being disturbed in the Quakers, in the Quaker community.
No, I was going to add that sometimes resistance can be positive. It can be done in a positive way rather than a negative one. So when we moved into a cul-de-sac in Indianapolis, where they had put out a petition to make sure that we didn't get there, and we definitely were not welcome in the cul-de-sac, but we moved there. And my mom and dad did things that were deep resistance, but were in a positive way. So they bought a color TV. We had the first color TV in the neighborhood. And so after school, all the kids came to our house to watch the colored TV. And so suddenly people's kids are in our home. And their parents are fine with that. And so it gave a way, in a positive way, to resist what people were thinking and to sort of dismantle that.
That is brilliant. I mean, just making it so that they can live the same way that they live their lives, they get to see you live your lives in exactly the same way, reinforcing that whole point that where's the difference? I don't understand. Yeah. That's beautiful. I want to come back to the point because, Jackie, you mentioned the Towson Center, I think is the name of it, several times. And it sounds like it's pretty important in the community that you live in. Can you tell us some stuff about the Towson Center?
Oh, yes. Townsend Center itself was noted and people enjoyed it. There was just a few white children there. There were a lot of light-skinned people, but white kids were there because maybe they married their father was white or their mother was white, and that's how they were there. They didn't just come from the south side to the north side, but they were just still a part of the community.
And what was the purpose of the Towson Center?
Oh, the Towson Center was basically, there was Attorney Richardson's wife helped to put more money into Townsend Center to build the building that's there now.
And what was its purpose?
And the purpose was to, they had so many people, so many students, so many children and adults. They had so many programs for the little building they were in. And so they built this bigger building with a nursery school.
Townsend was built in the north end of Richmond, and Black people, basically that's where the Black folk, not all lived, but many lived there.
Okay.
And many grew up there. And so Townsend functions as the point of gathering for the community.
It's like a community center for the Black citizens of Richmond is what it became.
Yes. And it also, kids were affirmed in church in regard to who they were, but Townsend also affirmed who they were. I actually think that affirming that you have a presence and a purpose and a place within the context of a society is also a positive way to resist. And that that sense of value and who you are was established at Townsend as well as in the church.
We have a similar place in Carlisle where I live in central Pennsylvania, excuse me. And it's nobody, there would be no problem, I'm absolutely certain, if white kids went to Hope Station. But Carlisle still is a very segregated by where folks live town. And so the kids that end up being at Hope Station are all kids of color. I was at a town meeting one time, and Hope Station is an old train station, and it's in what was the, what still is the black community of Carlisle. And next to it was the black cemetery. And the white town leaders in the 1960s decided that the cemetery wasn't being kept very well. So they took all the stones out and they made it into a park. And now people play basketball on top of the bodies of the community's 200 years of history. Carlisle should be on the map for racism in a lot of ways. It's also where the Carlisle Indian School was, Carlisle Industrial Indian School was. And it's now the home of the Carlisle Army War College, so the U.S. Army War College. And a black student at the War College, which is the graduate school for the Army, so this was a captain or a major, this black woman, she came to the town meeting and she said, "I know that you are not the town council that did that to this park, that turned a cemetery into a park, but you are absolutely the town council that's doing nothing about it." And while the stones were gone, one woman in town did tons of research to try and re-identify who the people were. And the town has now memorialized that area and turned it back into a memorial to the people that are there. And I was up there and they painted the names in for the people they could identify who had been buried there. And this little girl came up and she said, she asked what happened and they told her. And she said, "Well, if you took all the stones away, how do you know where to put the flowers?" And this 8-year-old girl got it. You know, this 8-year-old child understood, you know. So it's still frightening how easy it is to accept this stuff.
I want to go back to something that came up earlier in the discussion, too, because I listen to a lot of historical podcasts and things, mostly since I've started a podcast, like maybe I need to hear what they do, right? But a lot of them that I've listened to, they talk about slavery and abolition and all that. And the Quakers are frequently portrayed very positively in those historical podcasts. But what I'm hearing from you is that there's potentially undercurrents, even when within this community that's supposedly supportive, there's undercurrents. Can you tell me anything about that from your experiences?
I didn't start going to the Quaker school, church, until I was married.
Okay.
And George was already a Quaker.
My dad became a Quaker. He had been in the Marines and felt as though the Marines were the worst decision that he had made. He said he joined the Marines because of the uniform. And so when he got done with the Marines, the GI Bill was available, and my grandmother, who was a stern woman and a scary woman, demanded that he go to college. And he was not really, I don't know, motivated that way, but she motivated him enough to go to Earlham since it was in the town. And so he went to Earlham and he became a Quaker because of the theology that they had. And so I think what's challenging and hard is that there are people there that really believe that, but there are structures, but they don't live in a vacuum. And so there are structures that are in society that also are within them. And so they would have to deconstruct the stuff that they come with. And I don't think that everybody's always up to doing that work. And I think a lot of it is not particularly mindful. What happened was my father kept on pushing that with a mirror, saying, "You guys need to look at this." And so I doubt that you would find Quakers that say that there's racism within the Quaker community. In fact, they would say, no, we work so hard. Many do. But that doesn't mean that it hasn't impacted them. You know, I think one of you guys was talking, I was thinking about how in some ways the expectation was for Black people to assimilate to the way things were. And so we usually think about assimilation in the other way, in some ways. And so, but the cost of not assimilating was the cruelty. You could be disappeared. You could be killed. It was always about life and safety. And so it was easy. It's easy to keep people within that context if the lack of doing that means that you might be harmed.
Absolutely. That's the story of your clown ministry, right? When you, the fear, and every white person that's a racist thinks, well, no one has to be afraid of me.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But that is totally controlling that. We could talk to you guys all day. This has been really an incredible opportunity. Max is going to have the book available for people who want to read more about you. Also, if you contact your local library or get me the address for your library, I will donate a book to the library so people don't have to buy it to read about Jackie and Cindy and Dinner with the Kings. But it is so important that your voices are magnified, and I appreciate so much you taking the time to be with us today and all along.
And I thank you too. It was such a pleasure going along with Pat on that interview 9 months ago. I so appreciated your hospitality. I have never felt so warm and happy to be in a home as that. And Pat was talking about her Humble Pie book that I will be featuring on the merch for Sacred Legions, but I would love to send you another copy. And I'm sure you've got a copy from Pat. I have no doubt that she sent you a copy of the book, but I went out and I got my own Sacred Legions inscribed copy, you know, that has its own little inscription. I paid to have a separate copy made with the Sacred Legions inscription because I so appreciate the message of Pat's book. And I especially appreciated your role in that book. One, you got the greens recipe, which I look forward to. I've had your son cook that for me, and it's fantastic. So I really thank you for coming on the program, and I would love to connect up with you and send you a copy of that book, too. So I don't know. You can add it to your bookshelf.
World's Best Lemonade.
For the book, Donnie didn't let us know we had it until, Christmas Eve?
Yeah.
Christmas Day. And it was
a great Christmas present.
It was such a pleasure to read it. And I thought, really?
And that sketch of you in the book is beautiful. That is a fan. I don't know the artist. Pat gets some really great artists through the Charles Bruce Foundation, but they were spot on. You look wonderful in that picture.
Jeremy Ruby is the artist's name. Yeah. Well, I'm delighted that you enjoyed it. We're planning, if you're one of the folks out there in Indiana, we're going to be having a book event together again in Indianapolis next time. So we will be talking some more in person if people want to come on out. Otherwise, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, one other quick note, and I'll tag this into the end, but that event in Indianapolis, we do have a Facebook page, Sacred Legions does, if you want to follow us on Facebook. If we have an event coming up in Indianapolis, we will put it on that webpage because we want people to know about it.
Oh, yes.
So, but thank you all very, very much.
Well, we thank you too so much.
We love the opportunity to be able to talk about things like this. There aren't many spaces to have these conversations. So thanks a lot.
And there need to be more spaces, yes.
Need to be more.
Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions LLC. It is hosted by Max Scholar and Pat LaMarche. It's produced by Pat LaMarche. It's recorded and edited by Max Scholar. Original music created by the talented Jamie Callan. For more Sacred Legions episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. If you like what we're doing here and want to show some support, visit our shop at www.sacredlegions.com and purchase some of our merchandise offerings, or chip in a few bucks to buy a cup of coffee or a cup of tea in honor of my American British children. Ta-ta for now.